Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us as we begin the hour with a visit to what for many might be an unfamiliar Appalachia. Taking us there is Kentucky Civil Rights Hall of Famer and sociologist Bill Turner in his new book, Harlan Renaissance. He's our guest in this latest of Gerald Smith's interview series.
Dr. Turner, welcome once again to this program on racial justice and equality.
Thank you so much, Dr. Smith, for giving me this wonderful opportunity to be with you.
All right. Well, I want to jump right into the discussion of this new book, The Harlan Renaissance. Bill, in the book, you write, quote, that Harlan was to Kentucky black coal mining families in the 1920s through the 1940s what Harlem was to black New Yorkers in the same period. It was the cultural and social epicenter of the region for blacks, and as such, the blackest town for black mountains around. Lynch was equivalent to 125th Street in Harlem. Explain to our listeners what you mean here.
Okay, I was just trying to draw a parallel between this very well-known place in New York City called Harlem. And as you know, in the mid-20s, it experienced what was called the Renaissance during that period, which highlighted the mass migration of black people out of the South, particularly along the East Coast, Georgia, Alabama, over that way a little bit, but up through the Carolinas. There was this migration stream that went to Washington and Baltimore and Philadelphia and New York City. And it just became a mecca for blacks who were leaving the Black Belt South, seeking better opportunities a generation after enslavement ended. So similarly, there were many African Americans, particularly out of central Alabama, the Birmingham area, who ended up in central Appalachia. They ended up in eastern Kentucky. They migrated between 1890 and 1945 in great numbers into a narrow little tunnel that came out of northeast Alabama into the area of Chattanooga, Tennessee, and on up what Dr. King called Lookout Mountain. And they came into the Cumberland Gap down around Middlesboro, and they fanned out throughout eastern Kentucky, in Laurel County, in Harlan County, in Jenkins and Letcher County, in Whitesburg, in Fleming Neon, in Hazard, and Lynch, and Benham, and Cumberland. So we're talking here in an area of roughly 75 miles. If you put the point of a compass on Harlan County and drew a circle within 75 miles, that is where this concentration of blacks ended up in what I'm calling metaphorically a Harlan. While Harlan County, Kentucky, had the highest percentage of African-American population, there was a time in the early 1900s when the percentage of blacks in the population of Harlan County was twice that of the percentage of blacks in Fayette County and in Jefferson County. Harlan County at one point had 77,000 people in it, and some 20,000 of them were African-Americans. So we're talking about a place where for example, Gerald, when I came to the University of Kentucky as a student in the mid-60s, I don't know how many times I was asked by people, or I heard the statement when I told people I was from Harlan County, and they would say, we didn't know there were any black people in that part of Kentucky. And I would retort almost immediately, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but as far as my perceptions, I have never been to a place that had as few black people as I saw when I came to your hometown in Lexington, Kentucky. I called my parents and said, Mama and Daddy, they don't have any black people in Lexington, Kentucky. That's where I felt in 1966, because I had grown up in a community in Harlan County, and I had visited places that I just mentioned where there were just lots of black people. We were not ever kind of struck by this notion of being a minority, so to speak. So that's where we got that parallel between Harlan, Kentucky, and Harlem in New York City.
Oh, okay, great. You know, you've been described as the, quote, ultimate storyteller, and in fact, the master narrator of Black lives. Where does that come from, Bill? You just have a remarkable memory and an ability to just paint the picture, as we say. Where does that gift come from?
The oral tradition, as you know, is not anything uncommon amongst rural people. So I grew up at a time in the 1950s where lots of people sat on the porches, lots of people sat under the maple trees. You sat on the swing with your grandmom. You went fishing with your daddy and your granddaddy, and you went rabbit hunting with them, and you were always talking and hearing stories. And so in some sense, it came rather natural because our dad was a master storyteller, and he had several brothers, and they were all coal miners. And it was quite common to sit around and just listen to people talking about what happened at so-and-so time. And they could be very detailed to the point of remembering that something happened on a Thursday when it was raining in the morning. Also, by the time I was a teenager, I was fortunate enough to be sitting in classrooms by these master teachers, most of whom had attended Kentucky State University. And it was not uncommon every week at our school, we had what were called operettas, where we would actually have a production where you would get up and you would have to recite The Creation by James Weldon Johnson, or you would have to remember every line and verse of the Negro National Anthem, or you would be required to write a short story. So there were just all these colorful characters around my hometown. My family, my father, my grandmothers, they were all kind of storytellers. My grandmama was a bootlegger, so you would always have somebody around grandmama's house who may otherwise seem like a reprehensible old ruffian drinking moonshine, but these were guys that were just master storytellers. And then by the time I got really involved at the University of Kentucky as a student, I ran into John Stevenson, who was my advisor at the University of Kentucky in 1966. And John was later became the president of Berea College, and he could sew a yarn. I met Laurel Jones, the esteemed icon of Appalachian studies, who literally was one of the founders of the field. And Laurel is a great storyteller. And I was also very fortunate to spend 10 or 12 years working with Alex Haley, the author of Roots. And I got around guys like Dr. John Hope Franklin, the historian whom you know so well, and C. Eric Lincoln, a religious scholar. And I came to appreciate the spoken word. And I came to appreciate a lot how you had to have a detail for graphic memory, a memory for graphic details, smells, sounds, words that can conjure up an image of a person who's happy or a person who's doing a Baptist hallelujah dance in the local church. And might I mention, of course, that the greatest orators I ever heard in Harlan County, Kentucky, were that legion of preachers we had who could tell a story out of the Bible word for word. And many of these men were not necessarily trained at the University of Chicago Divinity School, but they were just called to preach. And so they were almost like natural orators. So the combination of all those people I just mentioned and the dynamics of that town we grew up in, which when I was growing up in Lynch, there were 38 nationalities. There were people there from all over the world. And you could hear voices that were thick in Sicily, or you could hear voices that had come from Croatia or Yugoslavia. And you also always heard Miss Willie Mae down the street, who had come from Bessemer. And so there was always a story. There was always somebody shooting the jive and talking stuff, as we used to say. And I am so glad that I was able to soak that up like a sponge. And I hope that I have been able to write it up in a way in my book that people will find relatable.
And speaking of that, people will find the book relatable. What message does your book give for young people in the 21st century?
Well, I think the main message I would give, particularly to marginalized communities, black people, rural people, which would be black and white Appalachians. I have a chapter in my book called Black Folk Done Lost Their Stuff. And in that chapter, I spend it talking about my grandmother, who felt that in the pursuit of being assimilated into mainstream America, in pursuit of the so-called ideals of integration, black people gave up, tossed out, released, considered old-fashioned, a lot of values, themes, ideas, attitudes, behaviors, and especially links to their past, which they gave up in pursuit of some modernization of being like everybody else. And they find themselves at a loss when it comes to cultural moorings, that they have little attachment between the past and the present and the future. And while I believe that we should stay in the moment, I have no problem with that. That's a very modern thought. But one cannot stay in the moment unless one understands where that moment comes from. So my suggestion in this work to young people is listen to your grandmama. Listen to your grandmama. Listen to your grandmama. And incorporate what things those people say. And they are telling you things that they did, which became the foundations that provided them the ability to survive all sorts of societal pressures, which constantly told them what they could not do. But if they can listen to these older people, what they learn is that you can do despite what the society may be telling you you cannot do. So my hope is that the kids will rage against throwing out the teachings and the lessons of the past generations, that they must constantly walk in those footprints, which will strengthen them as they go forward. It's kind of like things that come out of the Old Testament, and that you are constantly passing lessons down from one generation to the next generation. And so much has been lost in the communities we grew up in the mountains of the South, in the Appalachian region. We've seen so much loss, and we've seen the loss literally of the culture itself. And symptomatic of those losses could be some of the more negative outcomes in terms of drug abuse, alcoholism, lives that are shortened for various reasons for our behaviors. And that is because we kind of tossed out our cultural underpinnings, and we lose sight of the past. And in losing sight of the past, we don't have a vision for our future, and we tend to make mistakes that people made in the past.
All right. Dr. Bill Turner, you are an icon. And I admire you as a scholar for your leadership, for your courage, for your altruistic spirit. And we are excited about your new book, The Harlan Renaissance, Stories of Black Life in Appalachian Coal Towns, published by West Virginia University Press. Thank you, Dr. Turner, again, and you have a great day.
Thank you so much, Dr. Smith. Thank you for this opportunity.
Gerald Smith's series on racial justice and equality can be found under the series tab on our site, esweku.org. William Turner's book, Harlan Renaissance, publishes October 1st, and you can find it online at West Virginia University Press or Amazon. Over 30 years ago, Kentucky Humanities began a literacy program for Kentucky adults who read at third to fifth grade level. It was called New Books for New Readers. The series of books were written by Kentucky scholars, historians, and authors with assistance from literacy students and tutors, and covered Kentucky history, literature, and folklore. Well, now the University Press of Kentucky is releasing a 25th anniversary expanded edition of one of those books, Heartwood, by award-winning poet and acclaimed author Nikki Finney. Kentucky Humanities Bill Goodman had a podcast chat with Finney, and here's a portion of that conversation.
Tell me about the call that you received from a wonderful lady that we both know, Phyllis McAdam, and this series of books that she told you about called New Books for New Readers.
Well, I had only been in Kentucky about 5 years, and I was really focused on my poetry, really focused on being a good teacher, and my second book of poetry, Rice, had just come out. And I was trying to get that out in the world. And I would see Phyllis McAdam at the Carnegie Center often. And we would, you know, stop and talk. And she was so involved in so many community things happening via the Carnegie Center. And one day she called me. She said, I want to talk to you about a project. And I was like, uh-oh. I could just tell in her voice that there was something that I needed to sit down and listen to. She told me about the project. She told me about the new book for New Readers series. And it was like an arrow that went straight from my heart, because I was not a writer or a reader, Bill, that ever thought that reading should be some kind of elite act. It should not be something that only the scholarly or the well-educated or the whatever you want to say had a book in their hand. And I could not understand why more and more in this society that we lived in, that loved books, that loved the story, why was not more attention paid to the new readers that longed for a book to not just read, but to see themselves inside of? Oh my gosh. When she talked about that, I said to myself, I can do this. I've never written a small book of short stories or narrative verse, always, you know, kind of stuck to the poetry. But I was so in love with the story itself. And I was always challenged as a younger writer, still, I hope, in the same kind of way, when somebody I had a great deal of respect for, who was a brilliant editor, said, you would be perfect for this. And then I listened for the reasons that they gave. And I thought, maybe she's right. Maybe I could do this. Maybe I could write a little novella or a short story collection or whatever you want to call it that was not poetry, but had poetry in it, because first and foremost, I am a poet. So she had to call me, I think, three other times. I think it was a total of four calls. And then I was all in. I said yes, and we started the process of writing the stories. And then when we get to that part, I can't wait to tell you about actually the circle of editors, these young Black women who had never served as an editorial board before, and how they treated me and how they handled me was just life-changing. It was life-changing.
Well, I look forward to hearing that. You wrote in the first preface to Heartwood, which is... you wrote a new preface for the re-release 25 years later, but you wrote in the first preface, I have never felt more honored to write a piece of work than Heartwood. And then you went on to say in this edition, this truth has grown even more profound with its roots spreading out through every book I have written since Heartwood.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's a powerful sentence.
It's a true sentence. When I wrote Heartwood and when it came out, I thought, oh, wow, okay, I've done this little book and I've done this right thing for the community that I live in and for the larger world. Hopefully it'll stay around a couple of years. Somebody will pick it up and find some seed of something in it that they need, because it deals with some tough subject matter, I think, subject matter that we don't talk about enough. But as I was on the road with my poetry, with those books that I already had and the poetry I was working on, there would be people in the audience, Bill, who would come up to me and they would have a copy of Heartwood kind of tucked under their arm. And they would say, would you sign this? And I would go, oh, Heartwood, where did you find that? How did you get it? And it was, these stories would come out of West Virginia and small town Kentucky and the South, and sometimes even farther than that. And people would say, of all your books, I needed this story. And I didn't know it until I picked the book up. And I thought, wow, there's something that's connecting with readers here. I didn't even know. Maybe Phyllis told me this 25 years ago. I knew it was GED students. I know these were students who were going back to school to get degrees who had not been able to do that. So I knew the reading was on a certain level. I don't think I knew that it was the fourth or the fifth or the sixth or the seventh grade. I just knew that, as the Baptist preacher said in my youth in church, I needed to make it plain. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm a girl of lyricism and metaphor and all these things that I love to sort of complicate language in the beautiful way. That's okay. But when I began to work on this, I understood also that the thing that I would be most focused on was not complicating the simplicity of human beings hating each other. I had to make that plain, and I had to say why, and I had to show what could be done to stop that or to alter that in some kind of way. So I took my in my toolbox, which I tell my students all the time, grew as I got older and lived more and wrote more things, got very simple and very basic and very true to the word and true to the written language and true to storytelling. And so taking all that stuff off that I was learning as I got more aware as a writer allowed me a sort of deeper understanding of my world as a writer. It was not to complicate the subject, even though those things might throw a twist or might, you know, ascend a different kind of ladder before you, you know, all those kinds of things that we do as writers. But what I really needed to do was make it plain what I wanted to say. And I'll never, ever be able to thank this process, this project, and Phyllis McAdams for the opportunity to learn that as a 38-year-old writer.
I love the phrase, make it plain. If I had learned that much, much earlier in my career, it's making it simple and clear, clean. I know you use that in your teaching.
Yes.
Do you have a copy of the new release?
I have a copy of the old release.
Well, I was going to ask you to read this, and I if people will bear with us just for a moment, I was going to ask you to read the first paragraph of the new preface.
Okay.
So let me just read a couple of sentences there, because I think it goes right to the essence of what you just said. Before Heartwood, I was considered by others, and certainly considered myself, a safe to say, tunnel vision poet in search of her next bright metaphor, an urgent compressed line. I had been interested in all things words could do. I had always dreamed out my ideas in a kind of long story form, but I had not yet gotten to the place as a young writer of feeling confident that I could sustain that form or any fictive character all the way through a traditional short story setting. I was always a poet first, but I was quietly and dutifully interested in all forms of written expression in which people worked with great heart and head to not be invisible, though the world sought to make them so and to never, ever be counted out. And that's what you were doing and what this book 25 years ago gave you the opportunity to do.
Yes, absolutely. And I wasn't, and I'm really proud of this. I was a little unsure of this in my younger years, Bill, but I'm so proud that I wasn't trained by an institution. I don't have an MFA degree. I wasn't trained to write a certain kind of way. The people that I loved as writers were always in the community, were always listening for the human voice and what it could do. I was watching people and watching how people made a living. I grew up in a household and in a community where the people who worked with their hands and made things, those were the people that spoke to me in the loudest ways. I love the intellectual component of writing, but what I really loved was the elbow grease and the midnight oil and the pencil on the page and what it, the kind of work it took to do the work, but also how a writer is made. There have been other people who have walked up to me and said, you know, I've got this project. And they've told me that project. That's how my last book of poetry on occasional poems got made. It's because someone invited me, thought I had certain sensibility or certain understanding of a community that this might work well. Those other writers who have done books in the series, I have such respect for because of how they approach this subject in their own way as well. Nobody does this. Publishing houses don't really care about the people who don't have the cachet and the wherewithal and the education to read their books on this level. No one goes looking for these readers like the Humanities Council did, the Kentucky Humanities Council. So I was so impressed that this was a priority to a state, to an organization, and to people who sat there and thought, this is how I'll spend my time. We need this now. This, I'll tell you something that I wasn't gonna tell you because I haven't read this book in 25 years. I don't read from it at readings because I always find it hard as a fiction writer or a short story writer to like, where do I start? Because then I have to bring people up to speed. And it, so I just don't. But when I did get the new copy, I read it cover to cover. And I went, wow, you wrote that at 38? That's in terms of being where I was as a writer and unfolding my wings into a community and sitting with these women who were saying to me, okay, Nikki, we know you do this for your poetry. You got your metaphors and you got your similes. And I was like, oh, okay, you see that. But we don't need that right now. We need you to be clear because this subject is really important. You're telling a truth that we want told in the world, and we don't want it hidden behind any kind of thing.
Yeah. So there was a, in your writing life, there was a before Heartwood and an after Heartwood. And that's very clear.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When you can let me know that you're going to be back in the neighborhood. Yes. We're going to get those women that you sat down with at the Carnegie and we're going to have a reunion.
Oh, Bill, that would be so good.
And we'll celebrate them.
Okay.
And their influence on you 25 years ago. Nikki has been talking about Heartwood, which is being released by the University Press of Kentucky in a 25th anniversary edition. There's a new preface that Nikki writes, and it's just wonderful. And I hope everyone will pick up a copy. It's a wonderful way to celebrate words and reading and you, Nikki Finney. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for this opportunity and thank you for what you're doing there. And hello to sweet Kentucky. I'm going to be back soon, so I'll let you know when I come across the state line.
Bill Goodman's full-length interview with Nikki Finney is available for listening online at kyhumanities.org. The 25th anniversary expanded edition of Heartwood will be available at the Kentucky Book Festival, and there's more on that on the Kentucky Humanities website. Coming up after the break, a proposal to ungrade education. And why are there good reasons for bad feelings? We get an answer from one of the world's most respected psychiatrists. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council, coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts. Rowan County Arts Center will present an Arts and Antiques Fair Saturday, September 18th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Spend the day in downtown Moorhead shopping local art, craft, and antiques. For more information, visit RylandCountyArtsCenter.com. And head to Danville's Arts Center for the Bluegrass for an exhibit titled The Object Scene, a celebration of the study and practice of the still life as subject matter. Work in the exhibit honors both traditional realism as well as more experimental contemporary techniques. The exhibit runs through October 30th. For more information, visit artcenterky.org. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
What if the purpose of the courses offered in public schools was simply to learn and to be equipped with knowledge as opposed to being evaluated or ranked? What if education went gradeless? Dr. Matthew Winslow is a professor of social psychology at EKU who's been exploring this alternative approach to education. We want to welcome you to Eastern Standard, Dr. Winslow.
My pleasure to be here.
And let's begin with that question. It's asking whether the purpose of public education is to learn or to be evaluated.
I think it's interesting to reflect back on the history of education. And really, evaluating students like we do now is a relatively recent phenomena. I mean, really in the last 100 years, depending on how you date it. But most of the history of education has been without evaluating students like we do now. So certainly education can work without doing the evaluation. And I'm evaluated in my job in different ways, but I'm not really usually given a grade necessarily, and nor am I evaluated in terms of ranking against my colleagues, really. So I think this idea that preparing students for the future involves grading and ranking them now is really a myth.
Well, I know that you've said that getting rid of grading or ungrading is really not a practice so much as it is a mindset. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely. And some people have said that ungrading as a term is misleading and not desirable. But really, for me, getting rid of grades and scores and points is much more about trying to cultivate students' intrinsic motivations, their joy of learning, their enjoyment of the process of learning or developing skills, and less about getting them to focus on external rewards or punishments, which really detract from their enjoyment and also their progress in terms of learning the material or developing a skill. So ungrading is really much more about trying to get students to understand what the point is of our courses and of education in general. And definitely the point is not to produce grades or GPA or even a diploma, even though that's what lots of students think they're doing in education is getting a diploma, for example. That's certainly something that we emphasize and highlight. And it's a great thing about getting a college degree is the diploma itself. But I hope that our students don't think back on their time at EKU, for example, and remember their grades or their diploma. I hope they remember the learning and the relationships that they developed while they were here.
You recently hosted an online presentation about ungrading, and I was listening, and you said at one point that ungrading allows you to think of your students in a more trusting way, and that trusting students has been one of the most beneficial aspects of the ungrading approach. Talk to us about that trust.
It really is one of the most rewarding things about ungrading for me, because most of my career I've really thought of students, you know, I'm embarrassed to say this, but as sort of my adversaries, and I think they've seen me as their adversary as well, and I'm trying to do things to them, and they're trying to figure out ways to either get around what I'm trying to do to them or to do just enough so that they'll be happy or I'm happy or satisfied or they've met the requirements. But ungrading, taking away the requirements, taking away the points and the evaluation, really puts me into a position where I can be more of a collaborator with them, more of a facilitator, work with them on their development as a human being and as a learner. And it really allows me to trust students that they know what's best for them. I try to tell them what I think the benefits of doing particular activities are. And once they understand the benefits, then I try to trust them to decide for themselves whether they want to get those benefits or not. And if they do, great, I'm here to help them with that. And if they don't, I trust them to know what's best for them. I teach college students who are by and large adults, and I like to treat them as adults and trust them to make their own choices. And I think that allows them to trust me.
As a professor, as an educator, can you pretty much sense when a student is kind of gaming the system or your trust in them has been violated in some way?
I think any experienced educator would say yes to that. And I think I can as well. I think I can tell when students are trying to get away with something. One of the good things about ungrading is that the way they get away with something with ungrading is that they don't do as much work as they could, but then tell me what their grade is, and they might tell me their grade is higher than perhaps I might think it should be, or their engagement in my course might dictate. So certainly students have and will continue to game the ungrading system, but that's true of the graded system that I used to use as well. Students were gaming the system back then, and actually I think now students have many more resources available to them through the internet to game the system, and it's really an arms race to try to figure out the ways that students are gaming the system and then watch for that and create technologies or policies that try to get them to not do it. And students will always figure out a way around those policies and technologies. And the good thing about ungrading is that I don't have to worry about that arms race. I just tell my students, I trust you to do the work that you want to do. And really, there's no benefit to me of them cheating. The only cost really is to them. If they want to do not as much work, then they get less benefit from my course. And I try to be explicit about that. And so if they want to get less benefit and they want to do less work and still want to tell me that they deserve a high grade, I guess that's a sort of gaming the system, but it's really not something I see very often. And for every student that tries to game the system in that way, there are as many students who will undercut their own achievements and give themselves a lower grade than I might think is warranted. And that is more of a concern to me than the students who are giving themselves a higher grade, because these are students who are undervaluing themselves and their labor and their benefits from my course. And so I'm very focused on trying to help students gain an appreciation, an accurate appreciation for all they've done.
Sounds like a pretty good life lesson there. It might take a while to realize it, but you take away from it what you put into it, right?
That's exactly right. And I try to get that message across to my students as often as I can, that courses can be activities where the more you put into it, the more benefit you get, and also the more pleasure you get. There are lots of things in our life that don't work that way, where you just have to put in as much effort, and it's the more you put in, you don't get any more benefit out of it. And it's sort of those are frustrating experiences. But there are plenty of things in life, if you look for them, where the harder we work, the more fun it is. And college courses can be that way, especially if faculty think about that and try and design courses with that in mind. And if students look for that dynamic, that relationship between effort and benefit. And I think once students understand that the more they put into it, the more they get out of it, and that I'm not going to evaluate them on their effort or I'm not going to give them a grade on what they do, it's really there for their taking, then it really moves from their mindset of just doing things to satisfy some requirement to, I want to do as much as I can because I want to get as many benefits out of this course as I possibly can.
Have you personally experienced a student whose talents and whose educational progress has been unlocked by switching to an ungrading approach?
Absolutely. One of my colleagues, Travis Martin, talks about in normal classes, I would have, experiences like that with students who, I would see sort of bloom during a semester and they would kind of come out of their shell. Not because of ungrading, because I wasn't ungrading, but for other reasons. But it would be you know, one student a year or two students a year would be a rare phenomenon. It's a great thing when it happens. But with ungrading, it's much more common to have two, three, four, five students do that in a semester in each class, because students have spent, you know, most of their career as a student being graded and evaluated, and they don't like it. I mean, they understand the pressure of it and the anxieties. And when you explain to them that there's another way of doing it, and that different way involves just a totally different relationship to classroom activities and what they do when they think about a class, they really get it. A lot of students really get it, and they really understand the philosophy and the benefits of ungrading, and they really come out. I mean, they really come forward and say things to me in my teaching evaluations and in other forums that this allowed them to really lean into the course, to really enjoy learning about the course in a way that they don't in their other classes. Other classes are, you know, focused on requirements and deadlines and checking off boxes, and that's what they focus on in those classes. They really don't get much out of the learning in those courses because they're focused on those deadlines and points. But in my class, they can really get into the material for the material's sake and get some enjoyment and try to make connections with the material with their own life. And it's much more deep learning. This is learning that happens in an ungraded class is really a deeper kind of learning that really gives them the opportunity to change the way they think, change their life in a meaningful way. And that meaningful way, by the way, might not be in a way that I had anticipated. Many times students have told me at the end of my courses that what they got out of my course that was meaningful to them was not something I ever would have predicted. Huh. And that's really rewarding too.
That's interesting. Matthew Winslow, professor of social psychology at EKU, and we thank you so much, Dr. Winslow.
It's been my pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
How can the human mind be all at once powerful yet so fragile? It's a question that has captured the attention of one of the world's most respected psychiatrists, Randolph Nessies, research professor of life sciences and founding director of the Center for Evolution and Medicine at Arizona State University. Dr. Nessie will deliver the EKU Chautauqua Lecture on the evening of September 23rd. These lectures are free, open to the public, and safely live-streamed as we deal with COVID. We wanted to get a sense of what we can expect to learn as Dr. Nessie discusses his latest book, Good Reasons for Bad Feelings, Insights from the Frontier of Evolutionary Psychiatry. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Nessie.
Thank you so much. Glad to be with you.
And first, a definition for us. What is evolutionary medicine?
It's used in the basic science of evolutionary biology to better understand not just why some people get sick, but why we all have traits that make us vulnerable to getting sick. And why on earth do we have an appendix and vessels that run between the light and our retinas and narrow coronary arteries? Those are the kind of questions we ask. Plus, why do we have depression and anxiety?
Instead of asking why certain people suffer from mental illness, you ask why natural selection has left us with fragile minds at all. What can you tell us about your findings?
We would think it would do a better job, right? And there are several different reasons, not just one. The biggest one is that a lot of awful emotions we experience, like anxiety and low mood, are actually there for a good reason. They're just like pain. They're trying to protect us from certain situations. The problem is that most of the time when they go off, they're not actually necessary. And that's been a real focus for my research.
Well, it seems safe to say that anxiety and depression are among the more prominent consequences and features of this pandemic we're going through. How does your approach help us better understand and deal with these common ailments?
You know, every time I hear a news story about the, you know, terrible mental health epidemic created by COVID, I kind of wonder, you know, on the one hand, that gets people who need help into help, and that can help them. On the other hand, telling people who are having ordinary, normal, bad feelings that they're mentally ill, that seems to me to cause a lot of problems. A lot of my work is to try to show how often normal bad feelings are actually useless and what we can do about it.
So is this what you mean by the title, Good Reasons for Bad Feelings?
It sure is. A natural selection shaped these capacities for good reasons. And for some people, the system is just broken, you know, manic depressive illness and bad anxiety disorders. But for most of us, most of the time, these things are going off just like a smoke alarm in your kitchen when you try to make toast. It's a normal system, but that smoke alarm going off is actually not useful for you at that moment.
Your studies have also looked into the evolution of morality, love, and kindness, all seemingly in short supply in today's world. But is that a superficial view of the present state of humanity?
You know, I spent most of my career at the University of Michigan helping to develop one of the world's first anxiety disorders clinics. And we saw hundreds of people who had social anxiety. In the first half of my career, I helped them to say, well, quit worrying so much about what other people think. You know, get over it. And then I realized that there are good reasons why we care so much why other people think, that natural selection has made normal humans care enormously about trying to please other people. And it's a wonderful thing. It makes our species capable of love and guilt and morality the way no other species is. But the bad side effect is that we are so damn sensitive to what everybody thinks about us that it causes all kinds of problems.
Dr. Nesse, what do you hope we take away with us from your talk on September 23rd?
You know, my talk is not supposed to provide any quick fixes, but people keep telling me afterwards that they have a more fundamentally different understanding about what their own bad feelings mean and what their good feelings mean. And for many people, finding that there's meaning to their feelings makes them have more respect for their own feelings instead of just blaming themselves. Plus, it's just plain interesting to try to figure out why on earth natural selection didn't make us more robust, and why couldn't we be happy all the time? There are good reasons.
Well, this is going to be so interesting. Dr. Randolph Nesse, author of Good Reasons for Bad Feelings, Insight from the Frontier of Evolutionary Psychiatry. He will share those insights in an EKU Chautauqua Series lecture, 7:30 p.m., Thursday, September 23rd. A YouTube streaming link will soon appear online at chautauqua.eku.edu. Thank you, Dr. Nesse.
Thanks so much. Appreciate talking with you.
Dr. Nesse is the next speaker in the EKU Chautauqua series coming up on the 23rd. Eric Liddell coordinates this series with a new season unfolding under the theme Wayfinding. He's here with details. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure to be here.
What should we understand about that title, Wayfinding?
Well, as I think everybody will recall, the whole world was thrown for a loop a year and a half ago with the emergence of COVID. And in the past year and a half, we've undergone a fundamental reorientation and reckoning with that, with many aspects of our lives, you know, changing as a result. And in the course of the past year and a half as well, there have been a number of upheavals, such as Black Lives Matter, right? The social and political movement, reckoning with, you know, aspects of social justice history there. The U.S. federal elections were a pretty major upheaval as well. And all of this got me and my colleagues on the Chautauqua Committee thinking about, you know, reorienting and to engage people, to explore our assumptions and provide a variety of disciplinary perspectives on a topic that would help us better understand the time that we're living in and the best way to go forward.
Eric, you have already hosted National Geographic Explorer Wade Davis, and Dr. Nesse, we just heard from, he'll speak on the 23rd. Tell us what the rest of the season looks like.
Well, after Dr. Nesse, we're going to host a really interesting young scholar from Florida Atlantic University named Cristobal Salinas Jr. He is an editor of an important new journal on social change and ethnic studies, and he's going to be talking about navigating Latina, Latino, and Latinx issues, challenging norms of language, patriarchy, and gender. And that's our Hispanic Heritage keynote. So we're excited about that. That'll be coming up in October. And then after that, we will be hosting distinguished film producer and director Stephen Apcon, who will be talking about the subject of a critically acclaimed book he wrote called The Age of the Image, which is about developing literacy in a world of screens, cell phones, televisions, tablets, etc. And Stephen Apkon's book on The Age of the Image was chosen by the EKU Reads program. So we have thousands of freshmen reading his book this year, and we're coordinating with that program to present him in a feature lecture that is subtitled Wayfinding in a World of Screens. And then after Stephen Apkon, we have Meg Lohman, also known as Canopy Meg, because she is a biologist and botanist who has spent her professional life exploring the treetops, the canopy of the world's forests. And she has a brand new book out that's a memoir of her life experiences and her research in the treetops called The Arbornaut, right? Like the astronaut of the trees. And I'm really looking forward to that. She's a fascinating, not just scientist, but also educator who spends a lot of time talking to students around the world about the importance of saving trees and the importance of trees in our lives and the ecosystem as a whole, especially in this age of, you know, the climate threat that we're all experiencing. And then we are also planning finally to host a Native American Heritage keynote address in November, although I can't say anything about that right now because I have invitations out there and we're still waiting to finalize things.
Okay. So, you'll update us on that one, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, and I encourage listeners to consult our website at chautauqua.eku.edu anytime for up-to-the-minute information. Everything is free and open to the public. We are hoping to have on-campus, in-person lectures at some point this year. We sent out invitations in the sweet spot of May and June when it looked like everything was going to be wide open and in a certain sense back to normal.
Sigh.
But of course we've been thrown for a loop with the Delta variant. And so many of our events will be streaming on YouTube, and all of those links will be available and updated on our website.
Well, even if we can't be there, these all sound really interesting, and we can certainly call them up on our laptops and our mobiles and so forth.
Absolutely. And those streaming events are really interactive. Last year, we had all of our events online, of course, and there's a great deal of commentary and questioning going on in the YouTube chat. And so it's a wonderful way to not just get some information and sit back and listen to a lecture, but really to interact with other people in the audience and to ask questions of some of these great scholars and thinkers and so on.
Eric Liddell, EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series Coordinator. Thank you so much, Eric.
Again, my pleasure, Tom.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett our producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Eastern Standard is on air and online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.